And now for a bit of departure from our usual one-on-one interview format, as I meet with two faculty members, Dr. Mark Pegram and Dr. Brian Leland-Jones. I ask these investigators to present cases from their own practices that typify some of the greatest clinical challenges in the current management of patients with HER2-positive breast cancer. To begin, I asked each to present a case of a patient with a small node-negative HER2-positive tumor, and Dr. Jones began.
This is a 34-year-old, real lady, married, no children, had eggs collected for in vitro fertilization, hopefully after the treatment, total size of 0.5 centimeters, high-grade, LVI, DCIS throughout the breast, requiring a mastectomy, ER 90% positive, PGR 30% positive, HER2 FISH positive, very athletic girl, swims, runs, everything. To give Herceptin or not to give Herceptin.
What was her sort of overall attitude? Proactive about it or concerned about the potential side effects?
Very concerned from every point of view. Husband was extremely nervous, kept on calling me all the time. I went to the utter limit to try to get the egg collections. We actually arranged two cycles of egg collections before her chemo. She missed one of them from just basically pure nervousness. And just to give you an idea, Neil, of the state of anxiety, we treated her afterwards, without saying too much, with tamoxifen and then ovarian suppression with Zoladex. After that, she complained bitterly. I then referred her to another expert medical oncologist in a different city, and she came off the ovarian suppression. Feels a little bit better at this point, but I think a lot of it was driven by anxiety.
So, no children?
No children.
And had they been trying to have children before this all started?
Not very intently, no. They sort of left it, both professionals, the usual kind of situation, and then this hits.
What about in vitro fertilization, Mark, in terms of safety, in terms of the hormones that are given?
Well, as you know, there's little to no data on what impact that might have in terms of risk of subsequent breast cancer or relapse, but certainly the hormonal agents that are involved from a theoretical point of view might be deleterious in terms of that risk, and so it concerns me. We also know that the pregnant state itself may be associated with a blip in the incidence and risk of breast cancer based on epidemiologic data from Leslie Bernstein at USC. Who has shown in large population studies that clearly the pregnant state may be associated with a slight increase in risk of breast cancer and therefore maybe also risk of recurrence. So I think we have to talk about these issues with patients and yet acknowledge that they're theoretical issues and there's no clinical data that we can point to that can answer the question yay or nay or define exactly what the risk, if any, really is in terms of recurrence risk.
I don't know whether she asked you or this came up in the conversation, but if she had asked you what you thought her risk of recurrence was without any systemic therapy and, say, with endocrine therapy, what numbers would you have given her?
She did not ask that, thank goodness. And I think it would be very difficult to project these kind of numbers because for these smaller cohorts, these, you know, less than 1 centimeters, this is like, you know, on the verge T1A, T1B, for these small with HER2 positive, it's very difficult to work out a recurrence rate. Now, having said that, Neil, to me, pathology drives everything. And with this being so aggressive, this is one of the most aggressive pathologies I'd ever seen, I would have thought her chances of recurrence were extremely high. My guess is that this would have already seeded vascularly.
How much do you think that would have been lowered by endocrine therapy?
Again, very hard to say in this kind of patient, but I would have guessed with the ER positivity and the PGR positivity, even with the HER2, that it would have been reduced about another 8 to 10%.
What I typically do with these things is I do run them on adjuvant online with all the caveats and limitations that you might find from that. And what that is going to show, having run a number of these simulations previously for similar patients, is that the utility of chemotherapy would in fact be quite low. And so that raises a whole other issue.
But I mean, what risk would adjuvant have spun out of this, do you think? You know, baseline risk without treatment.
You know, HER2 is not a component of the adjuvant online.
Right.
But if you talk to Peter Ravdin, who's reviewed the literature on the impact of HER2 alteration on prognosis in large databases, the relative risk is about 1.5-fold for recurrence. So if you multiply whatever you were to get from adjuvant online, which is going to be low, it's going to be low double digit maybe in this case, and if you multiply that by 1.5, you're still talking about, you know, low double digit percentages probably of risk with no additional treatment even. And so if you reduce that by, you know, 30% with chemotherapy, the absolute benefit will be very small indeed. and the absolute risk reduction from endocrine therapy will probably also be small. The key issue in terms of tumor biology that we can have an impact on, I think, in this case, there's HER2 gene amplification. And, you know, you can argue in terms of hazard ratio, the biggest impact on HER2 biology is adjuvant trastuzumab. And so I would argue that probably the single most important component of this patient's treatment might actually be trastuzumab, perhaps followed by endocrine therapy, and the chemotherapy, I'm not sure, would necessarily be in the cards. But, you know, you could look at these simulations and see if the small single-digit absolute benefits of chemo would be something that the patient would want to take.
That 1.5-fold was multiplied for the HER2?
If you multiply what you get from adjuvant online by 1.5, that'll give you approximately what you would expect in a HER2-positive population.
Yes.
If you multiply the risk of recurrence by 1.5.
So just to add to that, then on top of that, Neil, supposedly an adjuvant online, you're also supposed to multiply by another 1.5 for the less than 35 age group. And then on top of that, you've got the LVI as well. And, you know, this was a horrible lesion.
Horrible little lesion,
admittedly.
So yes. Bottom line, Mark, based on what you've heard at this point, if this woman had turned to you and said, what do you think is my best choice, what would you have said?
I probably would have recommended a combination of endocrine therapy and trastuzumab, and I would have put chemotherapy on the table as an option, but showed in my best guess what I think the absolute benefits would be. And I think it is important to point out absolute benefits rather than the relative risk reductions from adjuvant chemotherapy to really put it into perspective in terms that patients can understand. And then I would let the patient, you know, weigh in on the decision. I'm not going to tell someone yay or nay when it comes to these gray areas. They can certainly have a role in the decision-making process. The other issue that comes up in these sorts of cases, of course, is whether or not to use other diagnostic tools such as the Oncotype assay and that sort of thing. I personally, in HER2-amplified patients, don't see a real need to use that particular assay because the data from the NSABP that's been presented by Soon Paik previously suggests that all of the HER2-amplified cases in the NSABP Oncotype DX dataset were either intermediate or high risk of recurrence. So you're not going to find a low recurrence score in a patient with these features with Oncotype. Consequently, you probably don't need to run it.
So what actually happened in the discussion, Brian, and what did you end up doing?
We ended up doing FEC followed by Herceptin, mainly because she was young and sort of wanted to be cardiac preserved, and we wanted to keep this as clean as possible.
Could I just
go back to you, Mark, just for a second? You said you would have given hormone therapy, if anything, with trastuzumab. So bearing in mind the tandem data on this, which has the very short survival times, that wouldn't in any way have discouraged you?
Well, that's a metastatic disease,
and then again...
But it does tend to show in that kind of disease.
It doubled the time to tumor progression in first-line metastasis.
Yes.
Consequently, there is a measurable treatment effect by the addition of trastuzumab to an aromatase inhibitor in first-line metastatic breast cancer that's HER2-positive and ER-expressing. So that establishes precedent in my mind that, you know, those types of combinations would probably have as much or more activity in the adjuvant setting. And I think you could argue that that data set could be used as the basis for the recommendation, even though the results are modest because it is metastatic breast cancer. But it's difficult. If you look overall at databases that have sub-centimeter invasive cancers, now, they're not all these characteristics, I'll grant you that. But overall, the, you know, recurrence-free and overall survival for these types of tumors is very, very high with standard lumpectomy and radiation therapy. And it's going to be hard to beat that with any adjuvant.
So let me just go back to you for a second. And I'm playing sort of tongue-in-cheek now and in a little bit arguing against myself. But again, if you do look at that tandem data in the control arm for those who were centrally confirmed ER positive, I believe the TTP was of the order of about 3.8 months.
Right.
That kind of order. Whereas for a HER2 negative population, it is of the order of 11 months, 12 months, which does show a significantly reduced effect for the hormone therapy in the HER2-positive population.
Exactly as we predicted based on publications on this issue of HER2 and estrogen receptor crosstalk in laboratory models since, you know, we published that in 1995. So that's exactly what we would have predicted, that HER2 would confer relative endocrine resistance.
One of the conclusions which Jose Bazalga drew from that study is the fact that those patients would probably need chemotherapy as opposed to hormone. So in the way that we're doing it, the chemotherapy plus Herceptin was the major treatment modality, and the hormone is the additive part on this.
I think the key to success of adjuvant therapy in this patient is going to be the HER2-directed therapy.
Yes.
That's the key. That's going to have the greatest impact in terms of proportional reduction and relative odds of recurrence. The hazard ratios across the board for all of the adjuvant Herceptin trials is on the order of a half. that is much more of an impact on hazard, and that's above and beyond chemotherapy.
I just want to clarify one thing in terms of what to expect at a hormone therapy in a HER2-positive tumor, because your paper showed that the ER levels were lower.
Correct.
But now what about a patient like this, who maybe is an unusual patient, who has high ER, 90%, granted the PR is only 30%, would you still say that she's not going to benefit as much from endocrine therapy, or because she has higher levels, maybe she would?
I still think that they probably will not benefit as much, but you know, there's no real subset analysis looking at quantitative ER with regard to response to, you know, Herceptin plus endocrine therapy. There's certainly data with regard to response to endocrine therapy alone. But in the setting of HER2 positives, that would be a really small subset and a difficult study to execute. So the bottom line is, I think this patient would probably not have a great response to endocrine therapy alone because of the HER2. No question in my mind about that. But that response to adjuvant endocrine therapy is still not zero. They're going to get some benefit out of it. So it has to be considered as a therapeutic option, and I think recommended for an ER-positive patient, regardless of the HER2 status.
Let me just basically bring this into convergence with Mark. We're dealing with an unknown here. There was a beautiful presentation made by Martine Picard at the Istanbul meeting last October, where she was asking, what do we do with tumors with sizes of less than 1 centimeter? And she showed this beautiful blue slide and two words written on it, nobody knows. So we are projecting here from metastatic data. So whether we did the right thing or not, I do not know. But if you do look at that metastatic data, Neil, and you look at Herceptin trastuzumab alone in metastatic disease, the TTPs of the order between 3 to 4 months. The chemo with the trastuzumab, the TTPs, whether it's a taxane, nivolumab, are of the order of 10, 11, 12 months. And Mark, this is a lot of your synergy data. So I would agree with you totally that the major benefit was going to be from the trastuzumab. But on the other hand, there would seem to be, if you project metastatic data, distinct synergy from trastuzumab and the chemo together. And now we are very worried about giving trastuzumab alone. There is no data for it in the adjuvant setting.
If she were presenting today, what do you think you'd do?
We don't really know. I mean, it's individual discussion with the patient. If we were giving the chemo without any question, there would be a taxane in there. And most probably, based upon the current state of knowledge, Neil, we would probably give the chemo with the taxane concurrently as opposed to sequentially.
Any guess what the specific regimen would be that you would use?
In this patient, AC going into TH.
With the T being?
Weekly Taxol.
Just to kind of get things out on the table, though, right now, what is your usual chemo trastuzumab regimen in, let's say, a node-positive patient? Same thing?
Yes, AC going to TH.
So you haven't changed anything as a result of the BCRG presentation with the TCH and all
that? At our point in time, no.
Mark, how would you answer the same question? What are you doing right now?
Well, let's just talk about this particular patient, since this is really the case in point. In a case like this, if I were to use chemotherapy, I would probably use something like Steve Jones's regimen of Taxotere and Cytoxan, because it's 4 cycles. If you're going to bite the bullet and use a cytotoxic regimen, it would be nice to minimize her risk of late cardiac complications, and that would take anthracyclines out of the equation in terms of worrying about the interaction with trastuzumab. So I think something like 4 cycles of TC followed by endocrine therapy plus trastuzumab, if you were going to consider a chemotherapy adjuvant option, that might be ideal. The U.S. Oncology Network is working on combinations of Taxotere, Cytoxan, and Herceptin, but I don't know that they have any safety data yet available for our consideration. So in the absence of that sort of data, I would do standard 4 cycles followed by a trastuzumab a la the Hera style of adjuvant trastuzumab. The other consideration would be a non-anthracycline regimen, again, in my view, just to minimize the exposure to cardiac risk, perhaps even later in life, theoretically. And TCH would be, you know, also on the table based on the BCRG adjuvant 006 clinical trial, which clearly showed in the lymph node negative subset that there was a statistically significant benefit in favor of trastuzumab containing regimens number 1, and in particular, the TCH regimen was superior in terms of therapeutic index because of its lack of cardiotoxicity, essentially.
So I do want to come back, Neil, if I can, and just say that this is in this case, which is one of the most aggressive pathologies we have ever seen with lymphovascular invasion straight the way through the 0.5 centimeter lesion. Most of our node negatives, node negative, less than 1 centimeter, we do not treat.
Just to be clear, going back to you, Mark, because it was interesting when the first BCRG data set came out, even though you all were saying, you know, we really can't tell the difference statistically between TCH and AC followed by docetaxel trastuzumab, I know I had asked you, what are you actually doing in your practice? And you were still sticking with an anthracycline.
That's correct.
Now, did that change?
Yes, it probably has changed.
I think a lot of people have changed since that presentation.
The first presentation of the BCRG-006 adjuvant cohort last December really, I think, visually emphasized, because of the way the Kaplan-Meier plots were presented, it showed it with an axis break below the 50% disease-free survival point. So it magnified visually the differences in the Kaplan-Meier plots between the ACTH and TCH arms. And visually, it looked like maybe there might be an advantage to the anthracycline. And with the TOPO2 preliminary data, which, albeit was retrospective subset analysis that wasn't statistically significant, we still wanted to believe that, you know, TOPO2 is the target of the anthracyclines, and maybe for that cohort, you really do need it. That was a nice hypothesis. But with longer follow-up, more mature data, and essentially all the cohort analyzed for TOPO2 at this point in time, there's clearly really no difference between the anthracycline and non-anthracycline arms. And in retrospect, if you would have done the Kaplan-Meier analysis last year and put in the error bars, you probably would not have been so impressed by that anthracycline arm after all, because the error bars absolutely overlap completely. Moreover, if it would have been plotted, as I've seen it plotted by the real database from the BCRG statistician when it was initially reported to the DSMB, the original Kaplan-Meier plot showed almost no light in between those two arms because it was on a 0 to 100 scale, as it should be. And so I think the graphical presentation of the data actually probably emphasized something that we all wanted to believe, which may, at the end of the day, may not prove to be true.
So, Mark, you have a node-negative patient, too, so let's hear about that.
I have a 53-year-old with a mammographically detected T1 lesion and had a 0.4-centimeter focus of invasion. There was no lymphvascular invasion. There was a component of DCIS, but there were clear surgical margins. A sentinel lymph node biopsy was performed, and she had a negative sentinel lymph node. The ER was 30%, which is just weakly positive. The PR was negative, but the FISH score was 10. And the question, again, is how should you manage these HER2-amplified, mammographically detected node-negative lesions? And the answer, in my view, is probably with a trastuzumab-based adjuvant regimen. But in the presence of ER expression, you know, the argument is whether or not the chemotherapy might or might not be dispensable, and there's no data.
So as you say,
this was a grade 3, and there was a lymphovascular invasion?
No, there was no lymphovascular invasion.
I think we kind of talked about this basic situation. We can maybe just briefly kind of follow up on this, but you kind of said somewhat emphatically the FISH score was 10. Does that make you approach this or think about this any differently? A lot of people have questions about that.
Yeah, and there's little data to guide us on this issue either, and so we really need to look at the subset analysis based on FISH score of all of the large adjuvant Herceptin databases to try to get a handle on whether or not the number of HER2 genes relative to the number of chromosome 17s actually has an impact on probability of response to trastuzumab. The data that I've heard about so far from the North American cooperative groups apparently suggests that there isn't an apparent relationship between the FISH score and clinical outcome following adjuvant trastuzumab. However, I must emphasize that the fraction of patients that have low-level HER2 amplification must be probably very small, and consequently the error bars around the hazard ratios in that particular subset will probably be very large. So I don't know that I'm ready to exclude a possible association between clinical outcome on adjuvant trastuzumab and HER2 copy number, but there's just no data to suggest that's true at this point.
But sort of inherently or intuitively, do you feel differently when you see this than in a patient is 2.5 or something?
I guess emotionally I want to, but I try to not let that interfere with sober clinical decision-making. So in the absence of any data, I probably would not use the FISH number to decide whether or not to give adjuvant trastuzumab.
How about you, Brian? When you see a high number, do you kind of feel like maybe trastuzumab is going to be more important?
Well, soon Paik and I talked this through, and we felt that there would be a good correlation, Neil, between quantitative HER2 amplification and outcome. And when he showed the data last year, and he did this parallel at one of our symposia with the ER data, you were struck by the lack of apparent correlation. So I would agree with Mark. Emotionally, you would take somebody, you know, HER2 10 or 15-fold amplified, you would take that as being worse. But the data from Soon at the moment, bearing in mind even the smaller numbers, Mark, would suggest that there's far, far less correlation there than there is for estrogen receptor.
Although there was an abstract represented at San Antonio, I recall, I think it was in a poster session, I believe it was a neoadjuvant study that did show a correlation between HER2 gene copy number and probability of pathologic complete response with neoadjuvant chemotherapy with trastuzumab. So these conflicting data sets, you know, sort of keep it on the table. And emotionally, I want to believe that there might be a relationship, but it's certainly not in the adjuvant cohorts. There's no data set that shows that that's true.
So can you follow up with this patient in terms of the discussions that you had with her and what actually happened?
I simulated as best I could, you know, what might be the relative risk reduction with cytotoxic therapy and with endocrine therapy alone, and basically concluded that the single most important component of her adjuvant therapy would arguably be trastuzumab. And I think together, after looking at simulations using adjuvant online and looking at the utility of chemotherapy in these small tumors with ER-positive disease, we together decided that chemotherapy would not be the patient's first choice, and decided not to use chemotherapy in this case, and in fact used endocrine therapy in combination with trastuzumab.
Which endocrine therapy?
Tamoxifen. She was early perimenopausal at 53.
Are there any situations where either one of you would use ovarian suppression plus an AI in a premenopausal patient off study? Brian?
We have used it once for a HER2 positive with ovarian suppression, and that was somebody who had high grade and was PR negative. The vast majority of our cases were giving tamoxifen and ovarian suppression to.
I have done it. I must plead guilty and admit, you know, in patients with 10 or more positive lymph nodes, what are you going to do? You want to try to do what you think might maximize biologically the probability of response. And I'm impressed that in adjuvant cohorts, you know, aromatase inhibitors are somewhat better than tamoxifen in postmenopausal patients. And so if you simulate a postmenopausal state in a premenopausal woman, either biochemically or with a surgical ovarian ablation or what have you, then you should be able to capture that same small but significant advantage of the aromatase inhibitors over tamoxifen, even in premenopausal patients, theoretically.
And I would agree with Mark in that direction. I think it's going to be increasingly used, Neil.
I guess we should maybe point out in terms of just trying to put this thing in balance, because, I mean, people respect what you have to say a lot, Mark, but in terms of your openness to using trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting without chemo, it's not something that a lot of clinical investigators are doing, and even oncologists in practice. So everybody kind of says, well, I want to at least stick a taxane in there or whatever. But in fairness, we should say that your approach is a little bit unusual.
Sure, and I don't suggest that everybody should jump to use this approach. However, in terms of enthusiasm for the approach, I think, you know, that there is a rising sort of swell of clinical investigators who want to tackle this
question in a clinical trial. It needs to be studied.
And we've been talking about it with the various cooperative group leaders, and I think that it could easily happen. Whether it would be a large enough trial to be randomized or not, I'm not sure, but I think that there will be data from clinical investigations in the future looking specifically at this cohort of mammographically detected subcentimeter lesions that are found to be HER2 amplified.
Well, it doesn't have to be small tumors, though. People are talking about this as the older, frail, comorbid patient.
Oh, sure. Yeah, if there was a medical contraindication to chemotherapy, fine. That could be easily an eligibility criteria and might expand the pool of patients that would be available for that line of clinical investigation. But otherwise, I think it's relegated to a group of patients with small invasive lesions. In that case, you know, they're infrequent. Only 20% are going to be HER2 amplified of the total that you detect. Many of them will not be candidates for research studies because they may have some other comorbid condition and have exclusion criteria, et cetera.
So you're willing to take that leap right now clinically off study. What about the issue of duration of getting out to the year? Do you feel pretty firm about wanting to get there?
No, I don't feel firm about that at all. And I think that the FENHER trial opened the door for exploration of short-term adjuvant Herceptin trials. And as you know, these are ongoing, as they should be. The problem with interpretation of the FENHER data set, which used just 9 weeks of chemotherapy and trastuzumab, is that though the point estimate on the hazard ratio compared very favorably with all of the other adjuvant trastuzumab trials across the board, the hazard ratio was in the 0.4 to 0.5 range on FENHER, which is right on top of where all the other adjuvant trastuzumab trials have been. The problem with that point estimate is that the hazard ratio error bars went from 0.2 to 0.8. So you just can't say with any sort of confidence that 9 weeks will be as good as 1 year. It's certainly suggestive that it might be, and it's a great hypothesis that we now have the ability to test in the clinic in randomized trials. So the French are doing a 6 versus 12 month trial. And I'm sure that there may be impetus to look at even shorter courses, perhaps as short as 3 months in the future. all this, of course, hinges on what we expect to see from HERA. You know, perhaps, Brian, will it be in 2007, the 2 versus 1 year data? Obviously, if the 2 year data prove to be superior, then the short courses will be quickly abandoned. But do you have any idea, Brian, when we might expect to see the HERA update?
Well, the Independent Data Monitoring Committee met, I think it was on December the 21st, and the only message that we had from them was to basically continue the trial.
Yeah.
So we don't know when the result will come, but the message is to continue.
When's the next time they're meeting? Or is it based on events?
It's probably event-driven.
Right. What about duration from your perspective, Brian? Assuming the patient's tolerating therapy well, are you pushing out to the year?
We push them out to the year, and we've had surprisingly little problem with pushing them out to the year. Now, I know that the B31 data showed that I think it was 26% total did not make it either past the AC or through the year. But in fact, we've really got the vast majority of ours through without any problem. I am impressed by the FINHER data. The hazard ratios, in fact, were 0.42 for DFS and 0.41 for OS, which are, if anything, slightly more impressive than the other studies. But of course, Mark hit the nail on the head. The confidence intervals on this are very, very wide. So for me, in some ways, I think it's almost a shame that the French chose 6 months instead of a shorter duration, because it's a very large study that. It's 8,000 patients, as I understand, which are planned on that. But it will be very interesting. And I do think the 3 month period, that kind of 9 week, 12 week period, will have real applicability when we start doing combined, like trastuzumab, bevacizumab, that kind of combination of two targeted together.
I asked you two to pull another adjuvant case, so let's talk about that. Brian, what have you got?
60-year-old, hypertension, renal failure, on dialysis, LVEF of 43%, 5 centimeter, ER 90%, PR 10%, HER2 FISH positive, inframammary and axillary lymph nodes.
How many nodes did she have positive?
8 positive nodes.
Okay, so we've got this lady with a big tumor, 8 positive nodes, decreased ejection fraction on dialysis. What would you be thinking at this point, Mark?
The basis for EF, I mean, was there any further investigation into the nature of her heart disease other than hypertension, diabetes? Is this a hypertensive cardiomyopathy, or does she have a component of ischemia as well, or does anybody know yet?
I believe it was both ischemia and hypertensive.
Oh, boy.
And she's already on a beta blocker.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, obviously these patients were absolutely excluded from all of the adjuvant trastuzumab studies, as they probably should be. On the other hand, I think we all have to understand that her risk of recurrence is so high, and risk of death is so high, that if you don't maximize efficacy at this point, she's going to succumb to her disease.
How functional is she? Is she working, or does she get around?
She's moderately functional. Moderately functional, yes. She gets around.
So best guess, Mark, what do you think you'd be most likely to recommend in her?
I think I would still be inclined to consider a trastuzumab-based adjuvant scheme and just, you know, pray that her heart will be okay and follow it very closely. I mean, this comes up occasionally in metastatic breast cancer too, and at some point in time, the patient's disease will be such that it is as or more life-threatening than the risk of cardiomyopathy associated with the trastuzumab. And when that boundary is crossed, then trastuzumab becomes a therapeutic option.
What about chemo?
You know, I think it's also got to be on the table in this case, and I think I would try it. I mean, I would quickly bail out in the event of any sort of, you know,
sneeze
of toxicity. I think weekly taxanes are particularly well tolerated. I would have to find out what the literature is on hemodialysis and paclitaxel. I don't, off the top of my head, know what effects it has on pharmacology of paclitaxel, but weekly low-dose paclitaxel, 80 per meter squared, let's say, is particularly well tolerated. I've used it in octogenarians. It would be something that I would consider. Anthracyclines are off the table in this case because of the low ejection fraction.
So you would give taxanes and trastuzumab concurrently?
Yeah, I'd probably try weekly paclitaxel trastuzumab.
What do we know about cardiac safety of a taxane and trastuzumab without any prior anthracycline compared to nothing?
Well, I mean, we have the data from several randomized clinical trials where paclitaxel trastuzumab has been one of the treatment arms. You know, for example, the Robert study comparing paclitaxel versus paclitaxel carboplatin.
And what was seen there in terms of...
Well, there's no real impact on EF when you use paclitaxel trastuzumab alone. We have the pivotal trial data, of course, in metastatic disease as well.
But how would you interpret the pivotal trial in terms of that question?
Same thing. I think that there's...
No impact?
I'm not going to say no. I mean, certainly there are anecdotes of pressed ejection fraction on patients who were even treated with single-agent trastuzumab. So you're not going to say it has no impact, but the risk is very low indeed. I mean, look at the BCRG-006 cohort, which was, you know, not paclitaxel, but docetaxel carboplatin trastuzumab, the risk of clinical congestive heart failure or grade 3-4 cardiotoxicity, I believe, was 0.14% or something. I mean, it was very, very low. It's certainly disconcerting that this patient is starting out with known cardiac disease, but it's more disconcerting, arguably, that she has such a high risk of recurrence and will probably die from breast cancer if you don't maybe give some attempt at adjuvant therapy in order to gain distant disease control.
So, Brian, how did you think this one through, and what did you do?
Well, this one was actually made easy for us, Neil, because the lady actually refused to have any kind of intravenous or systemic therapy. So, in the end,
what was her thinking there?
Well, I sort of hid this part just to make this case a little bit more interesting, but there'd been some kind of psychiatric history there as well. So on this one, the consensus opinion amongst the group, because this was presented at tumor board, was to treat just with an aromatase inhibitor in this case. Now, I must admit that, just as Marcus said, the risk of recurrence here is extremely high. I would have tended to have leaned in Mark's directions. I would probably have gone back to the cardiologist and asked if we'd have played around a little more with the cardiac protective meds with an ACE inhibitor as well, as per the MD Anderson data of Jean-Bernard Durand, you know, whether you could have kicked the LVEF up a bit more. And I think the weekly Taxol, paclitaxel, with trastuzumab would probably have been the optimal sort of therapeutic index, so I would have agreed with you on that. The other one on this would have been, you know, doing an aromatase inhibitor with trastuzumab,
right,
as we discussed with the previous case.
Absolutely.
But on this one, I would tend it again, because this is such high risk, if anything, to prefer the weekly paclitaxel with trastuzumab.
Interesting. Mark, you have an adjuvant case?
It's really a neoadjuvant case, if you don't mind.
Sure,
it's
yeah,
another primary breast cancer. This is a 49-year-old premenopausal patient who presented with a 9-centimeter invasive lesion and palpable left axillary lymphadenopathy. She had a lot of edema in the breast, but no erythema, so there were no true sort of clinical inflammatory changes by examination. She had a staging evaluation consisting of CT scans of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, and a bone scan, as well as panels of serum chemistries, etc., and there was no evidence of any distant metastasis. So this is a true locally advanced clinical presentation.
She was working?
Yeah, working and fit otherwise, and otherwise health conscious, I would say, and really was neglectful only on this issue with regard to her overall health. She otherwise, you know, had been to doctors for annual checkups in the past and things like that, but really was fearful of what she might find seeking medical attention here.
Did she express any sense of remorse for not having come in?
Not really, because I think deep down she knew all along what it probably was. And in this case, really, I think since she knew deep down what it was even before she had the diagnostic evaluation, it didn't come as any shock or surprise to her what the results were, and by that time she already had some resolution in her mind that she was destined to have to face up to this.
Brian, any observation on this type of presentation?
We see it quite often. In fact, I've got fairly high accrual on one of Dennis's and Mark's neoadjuvant studies, and part of that is simply because we're seeing quite a few locally advanced tumors of the order of 3, 5, 6 centimeters. And these are sort of split, Neil, between those who do delay and those who have really rapidly advancing tumors. I mean, we've got a lady that we saw a couple of weeks ago who got delayed over Christmas with treatment and over the holidays, whose tumor has gone from 4 to almost 6 centimeters just in like 2-3 week period. They're split between people who genuinely delay and those who it's rapidly growing.
Now, this patient was in good health besides this?
Excellent health otherwise, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Brian, how would you have thought through this situation, 9-centimeter tumor? Did you say the ER?
ER was negative, the HER2 was amplified by FISH.
Right. How would you have thought this one through, Brian?
We generally give these neoadjuvant. We generally follow something like a Buzdar kind of regimen where we give all the chemo up front. Our own leaning, if anything, is more to give something usually like an AC going on to TH or a FEC going on to TH, and we usually give 4 cycles of each.
But you're not giving the trastuzumab during the anthracycline as Buzdar did?
We didn't. We're not at this moment in time. But my understanding is that there's going to be a publication from Buzdar fairly soon in which the safety of that regimen is confirmed.
So, and just to finish that out then, on patients who have residual tumor and positive nodes, what do you do post-op?
We continue the trastuzumab out for a full year.
And don't add in any other type of chemotherapy?
We do not.
Mark, what did you do in this situation?
We wound up giving her docetaxel carboplatin and trastuzumab, and this was at least in part based on a collaboration that we've had with Judith Hurley in Miami, who published a paper in JCO last year showing that in a cohort of similar patients with very large primary tumors, that she had a very respectable pathologic complete response rate with TCH for 6 cycles, followed by a total of 1 year of trastuzumab adjuvant. I think the path CR rate in that publication, if I remember right, was on the order of 26%, something like that, which compares favorably with any other sort of cytotoxic induction for a locally advanced disease. And considering she achieved that in a cohort of patients with a truly massive median tumor size, we thought that that was quite impressive. And as a result, really had no hesitation recommending that off protocol in this patient. I must mention that we do have a TCH protocol that's still active at our center. This patient lives a great distance away from us and chose not to participate in that particular trial. But even off study, we felt that there was sufficient evidence for the activity of TCH in the neoadjuvant setting to justify its use here.
What happened when she was treated?
She had a fantastic clinical response. She literally had no palpable disease by the time she finished her cytotoxic induction regimen, but on histopathology still had residual disease, multiple foci of residual small areas of invasive disease in the area of the primary, and in addition still had multiple metastases, small by H&E stain, but in multiple axillary lymph nodes. She had several positive axillary lymph nodes despite induction therapy.
So post-op, she just got trastuzumab alone?
She got trastuzumab alone along with concurrent chest wall radiation. And, you know, you're always tempted when you get these neoadjuvant cases that don't have path CRs, you know, whether or not to give additional cytotoxic later on. In the absence of data, it's hard to recommend that, though emotionally, I think we all want to believe that will help. So we wound up not giving her any additional cytotoxic therapy and just gave her trastuzumab concurrently with the postoperative radiation.
Have you ever done that with any of the patients that you added in treatment afterwards?
We have. I mean, you know, sometimes we'll give 3 more months of CMF or give 12 weeks of navalbine or give 3 months of Xeloda. You know, you don't know what to do with these cases that have, you know, some of the cases that I'm referring to still have literally bulk disease despite induction, cytotoxic therapy, and surgery. And in those cases, you just know that they're going to have a local recurrence. And if anything, maybe you're at least delaying that recurrence with some additional chemo. But there's no data to support that whatsoever. And off protocol and probably in any other setting, I wouldn't recommend it. But we have done it, rightly or wrongly.
I wonder if 5 years from now we're going to be tossing it at either lapatinib, bevacizumab, or both.
In 5 years, probably not, because the proposed adjuvant lapatinib study is such a large study that I doubt we'll have efficacy data mature by then. I hope I'm wrong. I hope it accrues overnight and we'll have follow-up data sooner than later. But eventually, absolutely, I agree. Maybe beyond 5 years, I think we will have data that could well support the addition of small molecule HER2 tyrosine kinase inhibitors like lapatinib, perhaps even along with Herceptin or following Herceptin as standard adjuvant therapy for HER2 amplified disease.
How about Bev?
Bevacizumab as well. There are discussions between the NSABP and the BCRG surrounding clinical protocol concepts for studying bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting, both in HER2 negative and in HER2 positive patients. And in the HER2 positive patients, it's looking at it in combination with trastuzumab.
Let's talk about a couple of cases of metastatic disease. Brian, have you got a case you can present?
Okay. 31-year-old, 2 young children, history of mastitis after breastfeeding, large right red breast, matted axillary lymph nodes, bone pain, and a tender liver. CEA of 54, CA 15-3 of 311. CT of the brain showed mottled cortical destruction of the bone with dural thickening and lytic lesions in the skull. Bone scan was diffusely positive in multiple areas, and the CT of the liver showed multiple liver lesions. She had a skin biopsy which showed dermal lymphatics, inflammatory ductal carcinoma grade 3, ER negative, PR negative, HER2 positive.
So were you viewing her as an inflammatory breast cancer?
Well, it was metastatic because she got the
disease. But that the primary
was... We would have regarded the primary as being inflammatory, yes.
How old was she?
31.
What did her breast look like?
One large red breast.
And again, do you think this exploded overnight or was not looked into?
There was definitely a component of significant delay here, Neil. Significantly delayed, yes.
What a tragic case.
Tragic case.
And what do you think was going on in the brain, metastatic disease?
No, we think this was bony disease. The case was presented at a tumor board basically because of dural thickening for consideration of whether we should be giving radiation to that area.
Interesting.
But you think that that was reactive in response to the bone?
We think it was reactive from the bone, good. Not within the brain.
And what were her symptoms, if any, from the disease?
She had bony pain throughout the body, multiple sites, plus a tender liver, any, as well as some pain from the breast.
Any bones that were close to breaking or so thin that you were concerned about it?
At this moment in time, no.
Wow, what a case. Mark, how would you have thought through that?
Well, I mean, this is first-line metastatic breast cancer, and so I'm going to consider trastuzumab-based regimens if her cardiac status is okay.
Was
her,
it was fine.
It was fine. So in the absence of any cardiac dysfunction, then she would be a candidate for cytotoxic therapy in combination with trastuzumab. If she's young and otherwise healthy, then she could probably even consider combination cytotoxics along with trastuzumab, a la TCH. But I don't probably feel strongly with these metastatic cases about combinations versus single agents or which agents that you use as long as it's trastuzumab-based. I suspect that a 31-year-old will probably likely see multiple cytotoxics over time, and therefore it really is just trying to maximize the probability of getting some control of her disease up front and then palliation thereafter. This all, of course, would be used in combination with the bisphosphonate for her bone metastasis.
When did she present?
She presented, the core biopsy was done December the 1st, and she was treated on December the 13th with carboplatin Herceptin with pimidronate.
Yeah, there you go.
What were your thoughts about, I guess it was the first presentation at the San Antonio meeting looking at lapatinib and inflammatory breast cancer, Mark?
Well, my interpretation of that data set is I was surprised it was selected for oral presentation because of such small numbers. So it was interesting. It's intriguing. There appears to be anecdotal clinical activity in this small series of inflammatory breast cancers. The reason it was chosen for presentation, I'm sure, is that it was a unique inflammatory breast cancer trial, which is a unique feature of the study design.
The thing that was interesting, it was kind of hard to figure it out overall with the response rate with the chemo plus lapatinib, but the thing that struck me was that they had a 2-week run-in period of lapatinib alone where they saw quite a few actual responses.
That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, we know that the inflammatory breast cancer population is enriched for a very high fraction of patients that have true HER2 gene amplification. So it wouldn't be all too surprising to see that a HER2-directed tyrosine kinase inhibitor would have significant clinical impact on such a patient population.
What about this patient that you're presenting now who got started on TCH? What do you think your second-line therapy is likely to be?
At this moment in time, we would probably follow the Chuck Geyer data and do something like a capecitabine lapatinib.
And how would you decide between that and, let's say, keeping the trastuzumab going and adding another chemotherapeutic agent?
Well, you've been asking, you know, Mark and I where we would be in 5 years' time, and I have the feeling in 5 years' time that one will probably give trastuzumab frontline, lapatinib second-line, perhaps even a third kind of, you know, AE788, something like that, another kind of HER2 blocker third line. So I think we are going to go through, change our agents in that way.
You know, there was this big controversy about continuing trastuzumab on progression. And, you know, people would say, well, if the patient had a really good prolonged response to first line therapy, I might be more likely to continue the trastuzumab. Is that now going to, do you think, Mark, go totally out the window and people are just going to go to second line lapatinib?
I think probably there will be strong sentiment to try to change classes of inhibitors. I mean, the lessons learned from other targeted therapy approaches, a la the estrogen receptor, are that by changing the strategy of therapeutic targeting, you might be able to capture additional responses, albeit with perhaps somewhat lower frequency and maybe not as long a duration, but still nevertheless resulting in tangible clinical benefits. So I think that probably would be the armchair bias of the community oncologist just based on experience with other targeted agents. This issue has never been put to rest in a randomized clinical trial anyway, the duration of trastuzumab in the metastatic setting, which is unfortunate because once the tyrosine kinase inhibitors are available in the community, then it'll probably make that question impossible to ever address. Not that it was ever possible before lapatinib, but after lapatinib, it will probably be impossible.
Do you think there is any role for the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab right now off study?
You know, probably not off study. I mean, it is the subject of ongoing clinical investigation, so we will get the answer at the end of the day. We have a paper that's about to be submitted for publication now, you know, summarizing our experience with the phase 1 dose escalation trastuzumab and lapatinib combination. And at least anecdotally, in the dose escalation phase of that cohort, we had some very, very nice responses. I think it was like 6 out of 26 responses. And all of those 6 responders had had prior trastuzumab treatment. And despite that fact, responded to the combination of lapatinib plus trastuzumab. We just had a paper in Cancer Research recently looking at preclinical combinations of trastuzumab and lapatinib. And to our surprise, frankly, in these laboratory assays, we found synergy between the two. Our working hypothesis when we were planning the experiments in the lab is that they would likely be antagonistic since they're both targeting HER2. You know, if one of them is effectively taking HER2 out of the equation, then adding in another one shouldn't add anything. Another HER2 targeted agent shouldn't add anything, at least from a theoretical point of view. So in terms of drug-drug interactions, that would be predicted to be antagonistic. In fact, as the experiments were originally planned, we were planning to demonstrate that both the lapatinib and the trastuzumab were using HER2 as the primary target in breast cancer, in contrast to, let's say, EGF receptor in breast cancer, where there's no correlation between response to lapatinib and EGF receptor expression in cell lines, breast cell lines, for example. So to our surprise, we found strong synergism across the board in a few different cell lines that we tested. And that was the basis in terms of preclinical rationale for looking at this phase one combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab. That now has moved into randomized phase three trials, both in the adjuvant and metastatic setting. So we will get the answer.
Well, the other place that we might get some answers even earlier would be in the neoadjuvant setting. The NSABP is looking at, I think they're talking about doing trastuzumab versus lapatinib versus the combination neoadjuvant.
Exactly.
Because you ought to get an answer pretty quick.
Yeah, because you'll get a path
to see what the response are.
Absolutely. I think that's a wonderful study design, and it's a wonderful opportunity to get a more rapid answer and not have to necessarily wait for the results from the ALTO trial of adjuvant lapatinib and trastuzumab to get the final answer.
Brian, how do you feel about that ALTO trial, specifically the fact that one of the arms is not going to have trastuzumab in it and just lapatinib?
So, in fact, I was one of the people that argued strongly having the lapatinib arm singly in there and not just trastuzumab. And I think at this point we've made a lot of mistakes in the past, Neil and Mark, in terms of trial design. And I think now it would be a huge regret not to ask that single arm lapatinib question at this point, because without that, you don't know where you are. How are the two agents head to head? What is the difference? What is the advantage of the combination, not just over trastuzumab, but over lapatinib alone?
I mean, scientifically,
but
what about ethically?
When we were questioned ethically how you could defend that in terms of the very strong evidence of trastuzumab and how I would present that to a patient, now, you have to remember that this design was being discussed again around 9 months ago. So the arguments which I presented were, here you have an agent which is oral, which has shown substantial activity, at least in the metastatic situation, and which may have an advantage, certainly, in terms of the brain metastasis situation. So I would just present all the data out there. And also, there was some data suggesting there could be less cardiotoxicity at that point with lapatinib. So if you put that all together of potentially less cardiotoxic, potentially fewer brain mets, oral different mechanism of action, it is informed consent. And you discuss it with the patient. You discuss the limitations of the lapatinib database at this point, but you present it out.
Can you talk a little bit more about what we know in terms of lapatinib in brain mets and also lapatinib in the heart?
My understanding was that in the Chagaya, the capecitabine lapatinib data, that in that situation, if I have it correctly, Mark, that there were 11 cases of brain mets in the one arm and 4 in the other, which are very small numbers but suggestive of a protective effect.
Right.
As I understand it, with the study, which I think it's the Harvard-based study, which Eric Weiner presented, the overall response rate in metastatic disease was of the order, I believe, about 5%.
It's really low in established metastasis using RECIST criteria.
Yes, on RECIST criteria, which is very tough, you know, which is tougher criteria. At
least. It may not be appropriate for interpretation of CNS lesions. It may not be optimal, at least, for interpretation of CNS responses. There were, for example, at least anecdotally from some of the data I saw presented at San Antonio, more biological responses, at least using, like, let's say, FDG PET as the endpoint following lapatinib in brain metastasis, for example. But whether or not that will translate into any clinical benefit and whether you would expect any benefit in the absence of shrinkage, probably arguably not. But in this case, you're talking about adjuvant therapy. So the Geyer presentation on Xeloda with or without lapatinib certainly were impressive in terms of a numerical decrease in the incidence of new brain mets. on the lapatinib arm. And I think that is strong scientific rationale for hopefully prevention or delay of CNS mets in the adjuvant setting.
How about lapatinib?
Yes, I was sitting with a number of colleagues when the data was presented originally, and they were all very discouraged, in fact, by the brain met situation of basically the Harvard-based study. But it does really, they're very small numbers, 4 versus 11, but it does show significant promise of preventive effect.
What about lapatinib in the heart?
My understanding is the incidence is lowish. I think it was of the order of 1%, was it, overall throughout the trials?
It's very low looking across the entire database, and there was an interesting paper presented by Sarah Bacchus and her colleagues suggesting that there might be a mechanistic difference in response in cardiac myocytes exposed to trastuzumab versus lapatinib, and this centers around the activity of AMP kinase. And it turns out that in cardiac myocytes, trastuzumab has a measurable impact, a decrease in fact, in the activity of this AMP kinase enzyme that results in a depletion of ATP stores in the cardiac myocytes. And depletion of such stores is associated in clinical congestive heart failure, for example. And so it might help to explain a mechanism for trastuzumab-associated cardiac toxicity, whereas the effects of lapatinib on this enzyme really were little to none, or in fact, in some of the experiments, it looked like there might be even an increase in activity of this enzyme slightly. So there's no depletion of ATP stores following lapatinib in these cardiac myocytes, where there is in trastuzumab. Is that the biologic basis to explain this clinical observation of apparently fewer cases of cardiotoxicity in the lapatinib trials than expected? Maybe, but I just don't know. I mean, certainly clinical investigators have become very savvy and have become quite good at selecting patients so that they will have a low risk of cardiac adverse events on HER2-directed therapeutic trials, whether it be antibodies or otherwise. So I think we'll have to wait and see what the randomized phase 3 head-to-head comparisons teach us about whether or not there's a true difference in the cardiac safety profile between these two agents or indeed the combination.
So just to extend this in terms of where we're going in the future, Neil, I think at this moment we're relatively safe-ish because I could well see in our own practice starting, say, in the metastatic setting with something like a taxane with trastuzumab and then sequencing this onto, say, a capecitabine with a lapatinib and then flipping at the moment onto something like a navalbine plus trastuzumab again and cycling round. But in the future, there's no question the combination is going to be trastuzumab plus Bev or trastuzumab plus lapatinib or trastuzumab plus an mTOR inhibitor. And then one has to ask, when you've got the two targeted together, you know, how much additional cardiac toxicity that there is. And certainly, Mark, your data on the trastuzumab bevacizumab has stimulated, as you know, huge interest at this moment in time. And that is beginning to be adopted into practice in the community, almost in a worrying so based upon the number of patients. But it is,
I'm sure
it is
been
very
more,
encouraging.
More patients have been treated with that combination in the community than on our phase 2 study, no
absolutely.
Doubt, at this point.
Mark, do you want to present your metastatic case?
I have another metastatic breast cancer patient who's 67, HER2 amplified, had primary breast cancer about 3 years ago and had node positive disease. And this is prior to ASCO 2005. And she was treated with an AC followed by a taxane adjuvant regimen. I believe it was Taxotere. And 3 years later, now, she presents with liver and lung metastasis. No liver dysfunction per se, and her lung metastasis are asymptomatic, but she has true visceral metastasis, which are biopsy proven.
What was her condition?
She's in good health otherwise, takes no other medications. Her cardiac status was normal, and she's very fit, still very active at 67, so there was really no contraindication to any type of oncologic therapy at the time of her presentation of metastasis.
No symptoms from the tumor?
No symptoms from the tumor at the time of diagnosis of metastasis.
What was her ER?
Her estrogen receptor was negative.
Okay.
ER negative.
So, Brian, how would you have thought through this?
Well, at the moment, frontline metastatic, even if she is asymptomatic, we would usually give the Robert regimen, which I was second author on, which is the weekly carbo with Taxol with Herceptin.
What did you end up doing, Mark?
We used weekly low-dose TCH as well first, and she did well for a number of months, but eventually had disease progression while on weekly low-dose paclitaxel carboplatin Herceptin.
And what was her condition at that point?
She was still fit. Her blood counts were fine. She had no problems in terms of ejection fraction, still had no symptoms of her disease. Her progression was detected initially with a rise in tumor marker values. The CA 2729 was increasing, doubling, in fact. and she had a new hepatic metastasis, which again was not associated with any biochemical liver dysfunction.
So Brian, what would you be thinking at this point?
I think most of my colleagues would use either nalbuphine and trastuzumab or Xolair and trastuzumab at this point, although without any question, very, very soon, we're going to be moving on to capecitabine, lapatinib.
So if that were available right now, do you think that's what you'd be using?
Yes. Or
what did you do, Mark?
She received nalbuphine and continued trastuzumab in the absence of any data to support it, but that's what we elected to do because she had had a several-month time to progression while on the weekly low-dose TCH and had no contraindications to continuation of the trastuzumab at this point.
So what happened?
She was on that for a short period of time, only about 2 to 3 months, as I recall, and then she once again had disease progression, again prompted by a rise in tumor markers that prompted reimaging studies. And she this time had disease progression in the lung as well as the liver with new lesions as well as a substantial increase in the size of her existing lesions, but still surprisingly asymptomatic. And I think she had very mild transaminase elevation at this point, but less than 1.5 times the upper limit of normal. So just, you know, detectable transaminase abnormalities, but not too severe.
So what did you do?
At that point in time, she developed complications of her port. She had a port infection, followed by thrombosis, and ultimately the port had to come out. So we did not have great IV access. And the question at that time was, you know, whether or not to continue intravenous therapy with further trastuzumab-based salvage chemotherapy or not. And she chose not to have further IV trastuzumab, and we treated her with single-agent Xolair at that point in time. And she had stable disease on that for a period of time and then subsequently progressed thereafter.
So I guess theoretically you could have given her capecitabine and lapatinib, no port, but no problem.
If lapatinib was available.
Right.